135, present Representative Elmer Taylor Cotton and son Cherry. Two bills before us today, House Bill 225.
Are we on that? That's what Kenny said.
Yeah, this is House Judiciary. We're going to take up House Bill 225 first and then get to House Senate Bill 22. Mr. Snowden, do you want to? No, Representative Rundberg is here too. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Art Snowden, Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. Yeah, we're just on Senate Bill 25 on the helicopter. Yeah.
Basically, what House Bill 225 would do is would have local communities, except those with very few traffic citations that are off the highway and things, process their own traffic municipal violation citations. Approximately 90% of the citations that come into the court system are not contested at all. We basically do an accounting function and then pass the money on to the municipalities. And we believe that it would be in the best interest of both the state court system and the municipalities for those citations to be handled by the municipality. We think this is a good piece of legislation. It will allow the court to spend more of its time on the things that it should be doing in matters in controversy. We have offered an amendment or asked an amendment to be brought to this committee, to the bill, that would add a number of pages to the legislation. It adds about 12 pages, but what it does, it's very simple. It just changes a lot of statutes to basically say the cities set their own fines, basically, schedules. The reason that we suggest this, and this is supported by the municipalities, and by the way, Anchorage has no problem with this legislation at all with this amendment. They think it's good policy with this amendment. Juneau already does this completely. It has worked tremendously well both for the city and Juneau because they can better schedule their police officers and avoid overtime and things like that, and it certainly helps us out. But with this amendment, what this does is take out from the Supreme Court the authority of setting local fines in non-jailable cases. And it leaves it up to the community standards and the community morals. We honestly think if the community thinks that there's a large problem in that community with people jaywalking at school crossings or speeding within a school area, that they, through their ordinances, should be able to hike this fine up so that they would show that there's an approbation on the part of the community against this type of conduct. It's certainly something easily controlled, as we know, when something is passed by ordinance. There's a lot of testimony and things like that, and public opinion is certainly very much considered there, much more so than it would be in the removed chambers of a Supreme Court. Also, the Supreme Court admits freely, we really don't know how to set these bail schedules. I mean, we take our best guess, but we are removed. We don't know the local concerns. We think this would be a good idea, both for the courts and the municipalities. I do not know of anyone opposing this bill, any group opposing this bill. Any questions, Mr. Snowden? What's the pleasure of the committee on the proposed amendment here?
I'll move that we include it in it first, yes.
The motion to create a committee substitute with this amendment in it. Is there any objection? Hearing none, we'll do
Mr.
so.
Mr. Chairman? I'm just looking at the thing now. It looks very straightforward. But it's unusual to get a 12-page amendment without having a chance to, you know, with due respect, a chance to take a look at it. I wonder if we could, just before we move the bill out, take a few minutes. It just take me like 5 or 10 minutes, and we just don't take the motion at this moment, but we take it before this committee adjourns today. So I'll at least have a chance to read the amendment.
Well,
we can move it today, but just give me a few minutes to read it while we go on to something else.
Is there an objection to adopting the amendment? And then, if there's no objection, we'll adopt the amendment then. Any other questions, Mr. Sonny? Okay, hearing none, we'll close that off. We will hold this till the end of the meeting today.
Thank you. Yeah, and I'll make sure we move it before the end. I just want to look at it.
Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, Senate Bill 22. We need to finish up the testimony we were taking on Saturday, I believe. Friday? Do I have a list of...
I'm
going to
check my levels.
Are we in Anchorage and
Anchorage and Homer.
And Homer, Tom Starr, are you in Anchorage?
This is Anchorage, and he is here with other people.
Okay, I don't
have a list of the people who are there. They're just going down to the computer to get it. I just recall Tom was on the list from the last meeting. Why don't we go ahead and start with whomever you have at the top of your list.
Mr. Starr is standing by now. Mr. Chairman, members of the House Judiciary Committee, my name is Tom Starr. I'm General Manager of the Fiscal Light and Power Department in the Municipality of Anchorage. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 22. Shortly, I expect the Fiscal Administration and Fiscal Assembly will be deliberating, hopefully approving, the contract purchasing Bradley Lake Power in the state of Alaska. Then have an appointed administrative state agency pass upon the actions of elected representatives of the municipality an appropriate virtual public process. I urge you to correct the inadvertent error which emanated last year's APU sunset review legislation by enacting CFRS 2. Light and Power is also dependent on the action for the APU. PURPA Power Producer is attempting to prevent the municipality from contracting to try to take power. It has been implied that even if SB 22 is enacted, prevent this contract for power emanating federal PURPA law. PURPA can require a utility to enter into a contract to purchase power under certain conditions. But I am unaware of any section of PURPA which deals with preventing a utility to purchase power. It is ironic that PURPA is being used in Alaska to attempt to preclude just the type of power project that PURPA was enacted to promote. Hydroelectric and other power projects that do not use fossil fuels up to 8 megawatts capacity are classified as small power producers and are given a preferential status under PURPA. Such facilities must purchase their output. Bradley Lake is also necessary to provide needed competition in energy supply fields. What has happened, or rather not happened, to retail gas rates as a result of declining oil prices, took in the price gas prices. This most emphatically, Mr. Dale Teal, president of NSTAR, testified before the Alaska Power Authority the drop of 95 cents per MCF in the price of NSTAR's gas supply. The House Research Agency states a similar conclusion. Nevertheless, the price of natural gas to NSTAR consumers has dropped only 13 cents per MCF. This decrease was approved by the APUC without even considering formal protests filed by MLNT. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Are there any questions here? Tom, do you have the bill with you?
Yes.
I'd like you to refer to Section 3 of the bill, top of page 2. Do you have any comments on that? Is that section, in your mind, overly broad, or do you have any other reflection on that?
My understanding, Dave Hutchins will be suggesting some language which will probably accomplish the desired purpose and make it less broad.
Okay, so your feeling is that as it's written now, it's too broad?
Not harming the purposes of the bill.
Okay, is there any other questions of Mr. Starr? Okay, thank you very much. I guess I have a list here. It has Joel Rothberg at the top of the list. You want to go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would just announce for people, House Bill 170 is not going to come up today, so if you're here on that, you can check with Mr. Boyer and the Finance Committee regarding the contents of House Bill 170.
Sounds creepy.
130 or 150,
I can't remember what bill it's going into. 130? Yeah, I think they're doing something with House Bill 130. Go ahead.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to thank the committee for, my name is Joel Rothberg, I represent the Alaska Consumer Advocacy Program and appreciate the opportunity to speak here today. I'd like to just ask at the outset, has a copy of my remarks been received by the committee and distributed? I did send something down to Representative Sun's office.
Well, Joel, just a minute, we're going through the file here.
Yes.
Yes, we do have it.
The reason part that I had asked about that is I thought rather than read all the way through that, I could summarize that and perhaps devote more time just speaking to some of the points that were raised on Friday and today. At the outset, so we are here to speak against adoption of the bill on two principal counts, the first dealing with the removal of APUC jurisdiction over the wholesale power agreements with the APA. I would like to make clear at this point that, although it's, I would hope it would be obvious from the statement, clear that we are opposed to Section 3 of the bill as well as that part which expressly removes them from jurisdiction under any circumstances. There shouldn't be removed from the jurisdiction of the commission any aspect that relates to a reasonable determination of what the costs and rates of this the project should be, and whether it's the least cost, most reasonable way to provide power to the people of the rail belt. The, I think it's briefly one point, though I think Mr. Meninsky is here today, will also will speak of this at greater length. There is a question that which arose, I'll go back 1 minute. The other thing which I'll speak to briefly is, at the end, we're also opposed to that part of the bill which would deregulate utilities with less than 500 subscribers unless they opt in for regulation. I'll go back to the point of the removal of the APUC jurisdiction. There's a question that arose on Friday about this being some sort of accident and whether there had been some previous opinion by the Attorney General's Office about the jurisdictional authority of the commission. And as it turned out, there was such an opinion that was offered by Assistant Attorney General Carolyn Jones about 3 years ago, in which, as it happened, the opinion was that, in the Department of Law, that the commission did not have, for the most part, jurisdiction over the wholesale power agreement, the exception potentially being, or at least with an open question, was whether the commission could exercise jurisdiction under some kind of extraordinary exercise of authority, such as a management audit. What this would suggest to me as an attorney, I think other people looking at it as a matter of legislative history, would tend to negate the argument that this section was an accident. What it would suggest, rather, was that there was a recognition of a potential gap in the commission's authority that should be filled, and it was filled. I have to say, as the whole, taken in the context of the bill last year, I think it's rather kind of gratuitous flap of the legislature suggested something of this importance was sort of an accident. It seems like curious to me that a section which would permit, which would open to public scrutiny where it belongs, and a highly complex question of rate regulation, one which dwarfs almost anything else the commission's got in front of it right now, which would open that to public access, give competing producers an opportunity to have their say in it, and give it the kind of scrutiny it deserves, which is necessarily some kind of action because it does all those things. I'll address one of a number of things at this point in conjunction with each other. There was a question which the utilities have raised, yes, that what seems to be their main objection to that part of the bill is that by virtue of the spectrum of regulation that it creates would either greatly increase their financing costs or perhaps render the project totally unfinanceable. I would suggest that those fears, like Mark Twain's death, are greatly exaggerated, that the reality of the industry today is that the way the industry is moving is toward requiring the utility to get permission before they make a financial commitment of any size, before they're allowed to construct. They must show in advance that what they're offering is the cheapest, most reasonable way to produce the power. And it was only, one would think it would only make common sense, however, it's not been the way the utilities have operated today, though that tide is turning. A number of major states, including Texas and Illinois, Florida, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, a host of others, Nevada, have, in one form or another, by statute, by regulation, by commission decision, are now today requiring the utility to do precisely what the law at present says they should do, which is to come before the commission, before the commitment is made, to prove that what they are doing is in the public interest. It only makes sense, it doesn't make sense to catch a project like this or any other after the commitment's been made, and the utilities know this. It doesn't make any sense when you've got a municipal utility or an electrical cooperative, because the plain fact is, as they well know, that once the costs have been incurred, the bills have got to be paid, and the commission basically feels hamstrung to do anything else but to approve. The commission, the utilities, have tempted the bill to build in that kind of security when it's the worst possible way to go. An example of what can happen when the utilities have their untrammeled way is one which is very close to home, and what we have instance of Homer Electric and the Soldado generator. And I can say this from personal observation, participation with ACAP, both by my predecessor and the job of staff for 2 years, in a hearing which the outcome was basically foreordained, because the utilities made the basic financial commitment before for an $18 million generator, before they had gotten any sort of operating approval from the commission. Well, what followed was basically an accomplished fact that every step of the way, the commission was confronted by the utilities argued wreaking financial disaster upon them if they did not continue to approve whatever was necessary to keep the project going. And what you have today, perhaps consequently, is a utility in Homer Electric, which right now financially is going over Niagara Falls in a styrofoam barrel. That's they've got rates are going up, a 10% increase just at the beginning, going up, losing major customers, with no real end in sight to their problems. This is what you don't want to happen here. This is what the other states have taken action to stop, to force the utilities to prove themselves ahead of time when it means something. I was going to note here in regard to that particular utility, in regard to Bradley Lake, that in the midst of all their problems, within a couple of months ago, the general manager of Homer Electric was asked how much he thought the additional cost of Bradley Lake would represent for Homer Electric, even with the 12% share, is just one of the all seven Railbelt utilities. And the answer came out somewhere between $2 to $4.5 million a year. I noticed it's not exactly skin-tight accounting when you're talking about $2 to $4.5 million. They also said they can handle it. It's hard to imagine how, but that's what is confronting that utility. That's what could confront the public and the legislature if we don't get this kind of review. I would emphasize here that what we're saying here makes sense regardless of whether one particularly happens to approve of the Bradley Lake project or oppose it. This transcends that kind of dispute. It's just a question of public policy. Another point that we'd like to make is that the commission, the utilities will not necessarily escape commission scrutiny just because the APA is removed from commission jurisdiction. And Minister Minnitsky referred to this on Friday. I'm going to go back to emphasize this, what the problem is. In a sense, I say problem quotation marks that PURPA represents also represents an opportunity. But what it does do is say that the utilities, which can produce the power for no more than would cost the conventional utility to purchase it from some other source, are entitled to be hooked up. And there's at least one utility right now which has a PURPA complaint in front of the commission, and potentially one other in the form of SGI, which wants to hook up with MLMP, which began with a PURPA complaint and perhaps would proceed with that. The point being here that if the jurisdictional authority with the commission were removed and the contracts with the APA were allowed to sail through, the utilities were obligated to pay for that power, they could wind up, by virtue of a commission order, being obligated to pay for power from some of these other PURPA utilities at the same time. It doesn't make sense to take, and you cannot take that PURPA authority, jurisdictional authority, away from the commission. That's there by virtue of federal law and state law as well. And it only makes sense for the commission to have jurisdiction over the entire process, rather than piecemeal the way things have been done so often in the past. I don't have too many more arguments to make in this area, so suggestions to offer about it. I would say that one thing we have tried to emphasize in our remarks is that this process that has involved the Bradley Lake construction project has yet to receive the kind of independent expertise that it needs. It's been suggested, it's been heard over and over again in front of the Railbelt Energy Council, in front of the APA, as if that constituted the kind of independent expert scrutiny. It certainly doesn't constitute independence when the Railbelt Commission is composed of 11 members, 7 of which are the utilities which are promoting this legislation, the Bradley Lake project. Another is the legislators promoting this piece of legislation. The information, the analysis which is provided to the Railroad Energy Council provided by the Alaska Power Authority. As we suggested also, the Alaska Power Authority is not the entity to look to for that kind of independent expertise and either since, as I said, there's chairman and the members of the staff have been promoting the project for many months. There's just no good reason to take the authority away from the commission. I think as a practical matter, it has to be understood by the members of the committee and the legislature that even if they shave down the exemption in Section 3, for all practical purposes, the decision about what the cost of the project will be, what the rates will be, rests with the legislature. And if the legislature feels that it wants that responsibility, then so be it. I don't, it seems to me that something one would rather put in the hands of the agency which one has entrusted that responsibility in the first place. But also, in regard to that, suggest that it's, again, it's disingenuous to suggest that all this concern is the wholesale power rate that says nothing about the retail rates to the customer. The, and from the point of fact is that the retail rates are going to be predetermined in large measure by the power costs and the wholesale rates here. So basically, you're controlling the process. It brings back to the problem I referred to originally with the Homer Electric Utility. The decision is being made now. To me, on questions about which, for example, the APA doesn't profess any particular expertise about demand rates, and it's demand in the future, many years in the future, which is the crux of this problem, which has been the downfall so far of the Homer Electric project. That's the kind of thing, gross overestimation of demand, gross overestimation, underestimation of construction costs, that's routine in the utility industry, and that is why these other states have taken the step, which we hope that this state will take in the not-too-distant future, to require upfront approval. To the extent that it's already here in the form of the commission's existing authority over those wholesale power contracts, it should not be taken away. I will just make some brief remarks about that section of the bill which would deregulate those utilities with less than 500 subscribers, as we our opposition to that rests in that we don't, we think that would be an unfortunate move for the legislature to take. From our examination of the existing utilities, there doesn't appear to be any move among these utilities, which are largely remote, rural utilities, a lot of them wholly or largely native, for native consumers, to deregulate. We think that's the decision should be on the part, affirmatively, of those consumers to opt out. There's no suggestion, no reason to think it's a suggestion or testimony just because they're small, remote, and rural, someone can necessarily count on sound management practices or reasonable rates. To the extent that the existing regulatory scheme represents too much of a burden or financial otherwise upon these utilities, that should be something that's left to the discretion of the utilities and the consumers to work out. Perhaps they are starting to now. The commission has introduced a new application form. We would like to have the opportunity, they should have the opportunity to see whether that proves sufficiently simple for the purposes of smaller utilities. Again, if the rate making process is more than makes sense and complexity for smaller utilities, then perhaps that can be modified. Just here, the example, although I do this with great caution, that some sort of, in quotation marks, simplified rate making system could be considered. In any event, those are far more sensible steps as far as we're concerned than casting adrift these small utilities. That basically concludes the remarks that I had to make, and I'd be happy to answer any questions from the members of the committee.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions from the committee? I understand in your written statement here that it's your contention that MEA could be obligated to buy Bradley Power and also to buy Valley Energy Power under an order from APUC in the future. Is that under the PURPA legislation?
That would, that's a possible outcome of PURPA, yes. And it may well be that the power is from Valley Energy as cheaper. I'm not trying to cast the alternative producers in a negative light. They're claiming that their power will be cheaper. That's something they're going to have to prove. But as far as I understand the existing law, you cannot escape the demands of PURPA by running off to another supplier and saying, there, we filled all the needs, we don't need you anymore.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any other questions? Okay, if not, I'd like to go to Homer, and then we'll come to Juneau and take some testimony here. In Homer, we have Larry Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Larry Smith. My address is Fritz Creek, 99603. And I've think that to exempt Power Authority projects from Public Utility Commission review without providing for some other form of sophisticated independent analysis will plunge otherwise resolvable issues directly into the courts. Throwing the interests and wealth of the public to the wolves and destroying the confidence of a timorous bond market. Heretofore, approval by a public utility commission, here and elsewhere, is traditionally associated with utility management, and that for many years. This kind of approval is usually resolved with sufficient finality, significant issues which would otherwise remain to be litigated. If you think commissions are slow, wait till you are simultaneously or sequentially in state and federal trial and appellate courts, which is likely where Power Authority sales agreements and contract issues will be resolved if this legislation is enacted in this form. All costs may be considered, quote, prudent, but that term of art would not include feasibility requirements in state or federal statute. I think more independent review of the Alaska Power Authority is in the public interest, not less. We are all too familiar with the result of trying to treat residents of four dam pool communities, to use Andy Johnson's apt phrase, like poor damned fools. The Public Utility Commission should be given a stronger, clearer legislative mandate to bring uniformity and stability to utility affairs. The power barons in Alaska's energy kingdoms, the power authority and the utilities, have fought many battles with each other at the expense of the public. I've been chosen to serve on the City of Homer's Bradley Lake Steering Committee and on the HEA Rate Committee. And I've had my eyes open, and I'm appalled at the harm done by these power struggles, both to our utility and to ratepayers. We've been striving in the Cost of Service Committee for HEA to find a fair way to meet revenue requirements. Just a few years ago, HEA was in excellent financial health. Now we teeter on the edge of the death spiral so graphically described by Dave Hutchins in our utility magazine. What happened was, Homer Electric, without PUC review or REA approval, embarked on risky, expensive infrastructure building. Part of that is the notorious unit called Soldotna No. 1, a 40-megawatt, $18 million generator that delivered a rate shock to the peninsula that has really hurt folks, particularly the elderly and the unemployed who don't have the upfront money to convert from resistance heat, electric clothes dryers, and the like. Rates may be lower here than in other places, but bills are high, and the transition is painful. If peninsula people are not protected by Utility Commission review of Bradley power sales agreements, and that is the real fear of the electrical warlords, power sales agreements could not be found in the public interest and approved. If we are exposed to subsidized competition from Bradley Lake, specific provisions should be made to help us pay off Soldotna No. 1. After all, those agreements deprive us of a market for our generation for many years. According to the economic assessment for Intertide, without Bradley Lake, there is no market for No. 1 until 98. With Bradley, it's projected to be 2020. If Homer Electric is to be healthy, this unfair burden must be shared by those that will benefit. It's a basic principle of public works projects that they should benefit all. Just a few construction workers, and I've been a construction worker in South Central Alaska since I was 16 years old, 29 years ago. Do not make things worse by loosing the power authority. Much better is to improve regulatory control. Strong direction from the legislature is needed to bring an end to civilian casualties from the electrical wars. And please remember that contrary to what Mr. Laresh told you, the sole security for bonds is not power sales agreements. That gilt-edged security is people, people who pay utility bills. We are the security, and our ability and willingness to pay is limited. If you truly want to exempt Bradley, limit your exemption to that. For heaven's sake, do not extend it to anything the authority ever wants to be up to. To conclude, I would like to see both the PUC and the APA and the utilities made to better serve the rest of us, their nominal masters. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Larry. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Cotton?
Yeah. Sir, Sam Cotton here. I've been laboring under an assumption that the utility boards, having been elected and so forth, are one of the true market tests of whether a project such as Bradley Lake is desirable for that particular utility. If it is desirable, they may choose to sign power sales agreements. If it's not, they may choose not to. How do you view that situation?
Brad, the lake was originally conceived by the Homer Electric Board of Directors 35 years ago, I guess, and by golly, it just is not in them to think that there might be a better way to proceed, except there's probably a majority of that board. It remains to be seen. Tomorrow we'll be hopefully addressing the question of asking for relief for South Optum number one in the same manner that I did. In any case, the Bradley Lake project that they may have thought they were supporting is not necessarily the one that we're dealing with now. The project's gone through a dozen different designs in those 35 years, and it's finally been upscaled to probably the largest. But it's the power sales agreements are not in the hands of the Homer Electric or the Matanuska Electric Board, as I understand it. It's the Alaska Energy Generating and Transmission Co-op that gets to sign those power sales agreements, and our board of directors is in a position to make an advisory vote to the AEG&T, but that's all.
Well, that's sure news to me. If that is the case, I'm gonna find that out here too. But if it's the AEG&T that has to make the signature instead of the HEA board, and I see a lot of head shaking over here that suggests that that's not the case. But we'll make sure that you have the answer to that question. But apparently, the Homer Electric management, under the direction from the after getting direction from its board, will decide whether or not to sign PSAs for that utility on its own.
Sure, I wasn't dressing what HEA's power sales agreements for Bradley superfluous as they might seem in a time of so much excess capacity, but a specific way to help us to pay off all the elements in the equation, because we really can't afford to shoulder such a disproportionately large share of the burden.
Thank you, Larry. Representative Barnes, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, you'll forgive my lack of knowledge on what Soldotna number one is, but I gather from your testimony that you primarily opposed Bradley because of Soldotna number one. Is that correct?
Deliberately trying not to oppose Bradley Lake Project. That's not what this bill is supposed to be about. What I was asking for was help for us to pay for Soldotna number one, which is a generator that we've put in and have had so far no use for, which produces roughly the same amount of energy, I guess, as Bradley. But Bradley power sales agreements would keep us from taking any share of the market, and it seems that we're going to have an idle plant, and our utility's got some problems meeting our revenue requirements now, so it'd only be fair that if you're going to make power sales agreements for Bradley Light with whatever utilities, and I suspect it might wind up just being Shugach anyway, and no other utilities. But if you're going to do that, you're going to take any possible market away from our own generator, and we'd just like to have some help paying for that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Barnes, go ahead.
Thank you. Back to your Soldotna number one. What caused you to build this particular facility if you did not have customers for it at the time?
That's right.
Representative Barnes, that's a fairly complicated scenario. Our board, operating in the best of faith, was finding that the contract we had with Shugach Electric for 73 megawatts was not enough to serve the utilities customers. Shugach Electric, in the meanwhile, has been thrown into confusion because of their troubles, which you're probably familiar with. They said they couldn't supply us any more power, and based on the projections of the population continuing to explode on the peninsula, and the lack of belief that the Bradley Lake project would actually go forward anytime soon. After all, you know, you talk about something for 30 years or more, it kind of loses its reality. So Soldotna number one was designed to fill that need that Shugach told our board of directors they weren't going to be able to. And now that Bradley has come along, things are kind of overloaded on this end.
Okay, Larry, appreciate that. Yeah, we have, just for the committee members, there are three reports in your packet. The one titled Rail Belt Intertie Analysis, May 9th, 1987, in the appendixes has the power production capacity and retirement on the Kenai Peninsula showing Soldotna number one at 38.5 megawatt generating capacity with a retirement date of 2011. So, Representative Ulmer, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make sure that I understood what was being said here this afternoon. I apologize for my lack of understanding on this issue. I really haven't had a lot of background material or the time to absorb it, I guess. But I just want to make sure that I understood. There is currently a generator on the Kenai Peninsula, which you are referring to as Soldotna number one, which has a 38.5 megawatt capacity, which is in excess of current demand. And you are trying to ascertain whether you can get some relief for the payback on that generator at the same time that we're contemplating constructing additional capacity to reach the same group of users. Is that accurate?
I would hope that our life wouldn't be further complicated by signing power sales agreements for Bradley. Our utility might not do that, and you guys could just sweep that power right off the peninsula, and that would make me pretty happy. But we still have the problem of you absorbing the market in the rest of the rail belt that we had planned to use all that number one to supply, and in addition to our own needs.
What is your current need for power in comparison to the 38.5 megawatt capacity of Soldotna number one?
Well, that's we have a contract for all of our power with the AEG&T, which is an organization composed of MEA and AGA. That contract calls for them to supply us 73 megawatts a month, whether we use it or not, and we use close to that in the winter time. In the winter before this, we used more than that. In the summertime, we only use 55 megawatts. There is a great deal of other generating capacity on the peninsula, too, and a lot of our sales since Chugach supplies the AEG&T, the Alaska Energy Generation and Transmission Co-op, from Beluga. We have the benefit of that as well.
Thank you much, Larry. I just want to follow up on a couple of questions. One, you mentioned Soldotna 1 cost $18 million. Did I hear you right?
Yes, that's true.
So you got about 40 megawatts of power for $18 million out of that. And we're looking at about 40 to, with peaking of 90 in the Bradley project for about $350 million. Is that right?
Yes, but the fuel costs are supposed to take up a lot of that difference. That was a good analogy, I thought, was one that the Sorrell mechanical engineer broached in our committee, which was that Bradley Lake is maybe like buying a Cadillac, but you have free fuel for the life, so it might make it worth more to you than your Volkswagen. Unless, of course, I guess you have to build a superhighway for the Cadillac to run on, which would be the analogy of the intertie.
As long as you're not going over Niagara.
Thank you, Larry. Also in our report, this is the May 9th intertie analysis report, that it mentions in here, and in analyzing the Kenai Peninsula, that Tesoro is looking to co-generate its own electrical power in conjunction with Union Chemical, which they've given or indicated that they do not plan to force HEA to purchase their inexpensive electricity, and they will stair-step their demand off of HEA to reduce the shock, but that they make up about 25% of the HEA demand now. And what's the result of them going off of the off of your purchasers and taking
Sam?
Basically 25% of your use away?
Well, if the Tesoro were to do that, it would deliver a tremendous great shock to every other class of consumer on the peninsula, and if there is such a thing as a death spiral, I'm sure we would be right in it in that case. Already people are that can afford to are converting from resistance heat and doing all kinds of other kinds of conservation measures because of the increases in electrical bills, and that's the Soros need for more steam and the requirements that their insurance company has for them are going to cause them, I think, to get partly off, but hopefully they're only going to get off gradually.
Yeah, okay, Larry, so it's your understanding that, one, they are going to get off of the HEA system. That our report indicates that they're planning to stair-step their demand off to try to reduce the rate shock, so I just wanted to verify that the information we have here is accurate. Is that correct?
To the best of my knowledge, and we don't deal with the higher echelons of Tesoro, obviously, but the local folks for Tesoro are aware of the problems that Homer Electric would face if they took advantage of what's a very good deal for them, and they hopefully by the end of June will have made a decision to get off incrementally rather than all at once.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions of Mr. Smith? Representative Cott.
Yeah, Mr. Smith, I'm looking at some other work that our House Research has done on this. By the way, they've produced five or six pretty detailed pieces of analysis, and one of them deals with projected demand. And although you're correct on Soldotna 1 lasting until, I think, 2011, the actual demand, depending on who you listen to, the APA suggests that there will be additional capacity required in 1991, and our research people suggest that with an adjustment to the population, that they would, suggest a little more accurate, that there would be a need, but not until 1998. But even under that situation, there would still be a considerable savings to construct Bradley Lake when compared to gas plant construction in the same period.
Well, I don't have all those memos from House Research. But I do have the Railroad Intertype Proposal Preliminary Economic Assessment, and I was relying on that. That's a Power Authority document. And according to their table on page 18, Kenai Reserve Margins, which I know can't stand alone, but it shows that as of 1991, we will have a reserve margin of 98.962, almost 99%, and that it's not until the year 2020 that this futuristic reserve margin falls to 40%, which is what the Power Authority claims is a desirable reserve. Other people think we can get by with 30%. I see House Research thinks that Anchorage can get by with 25%. But the targeting on 1998 is what I came up with from reading a couple of those documents. I don't think the retirement schedule for Soldotna number one is anywise accurate. If we don't get to use it, the thing will last forever.
Okay, thanks. I don't have my other charts in front of me here to check the check against the reserve capacity requirements for the different years. I'll try to find that and get back to you.
My name's Sharon Macklin. I'm representing.
You have to speak pretty directly into that mic. It's pretty direct.
Can you push this backwards?
Mm-hmm. Push it away from you.
My name is Sharon Macklin. I represent the Alaska Telephone Association, and we're interested in supporting Section 4 of Senate Bill 22. It begins on page 2, line 6, and it's a section that would exempt utility companies with 500 subscribers or less from regulations. According to our records, there's approximately five local telephone companies that would be exempt under this portion of this legislation. And what has been done to change the existing statute, which would exempt utility companies that grossed under 50,000, we're now going to an amount of subscribers, since the 50,000 no longer is applicable. And for your information, the amount was changed from 25,000 to 50,000 in 1980, and we are now again looking at an adjustment. I think there have been some questions regarding the last sentence of that section that would not allow the APUC to combine revenues of subscribers, revenues of utility companies owned by the same company, and that portion is in there specifically for Yukon Telephone Company. The owners, Cliff and Paula Eller, also own an electric company, and that would disallow them to be exempt if they could be combined. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer them for you.
Representative Cotton?
Yeah, on the question of the $25,000 versus the $50,000, that was an adjustment for inflation and so forth, I assume. What about the 500 customers?
Where did that number come from?
I mean, is that an adjustment as well?
Well, the original bill, Senate Bill 22, originally had 250 customers, and we took a look at that. That would only allow, I believe, two companies to fall under that in the telephone industry, and I've got some information on the electric companies, but I think there's probably somebody else here who could address that. 500 customers was an amount that would allow five little companies to be exempt from this.
Which ones?
We have that in our material. I'm trying to find it. Mr. Chairman, do you know where it is in the material?
I actually have the answer.
Yeah, I can give you the names of the companies, but I think you have
send you the Coghill Memorandum.
In concrete.
They are Whittier Telephone Company that has 178 subscribers. Bushtel that has 347. Yukon Telephone Company has 333 customers. Muckluck Telephone with 478. And Battles with 50.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But that's Mr. Chairman. According to what we have, Sharon, from Senator Coghill, we have it looks like it may be possibly a more complete list.
That's the same one that I have, which includes electric. I'm just talking about telephone. There are two companies that aren't on this printout that are members of the Alaska Telephone Association. I have a directory of member organizations that also gives the amount of customers they have. And Muckluck and Battles are not on your printout, but they are members of the Telephone Association and do have less than 500 subscribers. And I'm not sure why they aren't included in this. I understood this information was from the APUC.
Battles and what was the other one?
Muckluck, which is Bob Lodgett owns that. And in fact, I understand after talking to Ted Lane of the Alaska Telephone Association, an example of why this legislation is wanted by these small companies is that several years ago when Bob Lodgett wanted a rate increase for Muckluck Telephone Company, he had to borrow money on his life insurance, about $25,000, in order to put together a rate case to go in front of the APUC. And he was granted a rate increase, and of course that money was, the costs were passed on to his subscribers, his customers.
Yeah. Representative Navar?
Yeah, how many telephone companies are exempted under the current limit?
I don't think any of them, but I know Ted Meninsky is on the other, is in Anchorage at the other end of the teleconference. He might be able to respond to that.
Is there any other questions? Representative Ulmer?
What do you think the impact will be of expanding the exemption?
Well, what these companies are hoping is that they will not be regulated, and that will in turn save them a lot of money, and they feel that they can pass that on to their subscribers. And of course there is language in the legislation and in the existing statute that protects consumers so that if they feel they do want to be regulated, they need a petition of 25% of their subscribers to petition the APUC to become regulated. So there is a check and balance.
So even if we exempt these additional companies, if their ratepayers feel as though they have somehow been not treated fairly as a result of becoming exempted, they can opt back in?
Definitely.
Representative Navar?
Yeah, is there currently a provision for opting out?
I
believe there is, according to staff.
I think so.
I believe there is, too. That's the question. Who do you want to put the burden on?
Yeah, there are apparently two utilities that were deregulated at one time who voted to be regulated that we would now be deregulating. And I would guess if they want to be regulated again, they're going to have another election, which is kind of complicated. I have a couple of questions here. I want to make sure that, do you have any objection to any provision in the statute where they have the the ability to have an election to opt back in under regulation?
No, of course not.
Okay. And secondly, on line 12, I didn't understand that where you say different utilities, you made a different connotation on it. You said electric and telephone utilities, two different types of utilities, which is a little different way. I wasn't reading that way. I read it as separate utilities and separate towns, but would you have any objection if we changed that to electric and telephone utilities then?
No, that would be fine. That would protect the intent of the language.
Okay, yeah, that clarifies that line quite a bit for me. I didn't understand what different utilities meant.
It could be either one, the electric and telephone, or several telephone, or several electric.
Yeah, but this exception would, this combination then would be, you just can't combine the electric and the telephone together. They could still hold all electric separate or all telephone separate.
Yeah, they could.
Any other questions of Karen? Okay, I appreciate your testimony. It's one of the rare testimonies we get actually on a section of the bill.
Thank you.
Original bill. Okay, back on the teleconference, I think we have a couple people left in Anchorage. Jeff Bowman. I have Ted down here too, but I think he testified on Friday. We'll go to Jeff.
Thank you, Chairman Sun, members of the committee. First of all, I wanted to advise you that Mr. Meninsky does have additional information to provide, so you, if possible at all, should include him within your as-yet-to-testify list.
Okay, I'll do that. Yeah, I knew we'd heard from him earlier. I thought maybe he was just there to listen. If he has new information, we'll take that next.
Again, my name is Jeff Bowman. I'm speaking on behalf of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group and its 2,300 members located throughout Alaska. We are extremely concerned about both the specific language of Senate Bill 22 and the broader context within which it has been placed, both by the sponsor and virtually all other speakers as to the legislation. In an effort to respond at both levels, I will first speak to specific sections of the bill, saving the more controversial for the end. First of all, with regard to Section 3 of the legislation, I am going to try and isolate this from the implications of Sections 1 and 2. ACFERG is entirely opposed to the notion of Section 3 that would, in essence, offer a blank check to utilities to try to reallocate as many costs as possible, whether prudent or not, into those portions of their expenditures which relate to Alaska Power Authority contracts. We feel that this places too large and too unjust an avenue for the inappropriate allocation of imprudently managed or uneconomic expenditures into areas where they would be automatically passed on to consumers without any kind of adequate review. With regard to Section 4, the section that the previous speaker was just addressing, we are thoroughly convinced that further reduction of regulatory oversight on the part of the Public Utilities Commission is not at all in the interest of consumers. Whether they be from small utilities or large, consumers have only the Public Utilities Commission to rely on in reviewing the appropriateness, that is, the justness and reasonability of costs which are sought to be passed on to them through the rate-making process. And I will speak to this again in the larger issue. But for now, I will simply say that it is imperative that the regulatory oversight of the Commission as it exists be maintained. As the previous speaker conveniently did not know, and I found that to be somewhat distressing, it is currently true that consumers may opt out if they feel that it is inappropriate or unnecessary to have regulatory review. It's our feeling that the spirit that several members of the committee have expressed, that the public, in fact, be involved, and I will get to those questions with regard to municipal and co-op-owned utilities, that principle certainly must apply with these small utilities, many of which are privately owned and which would not have any kind of consumer involvement on a regular basis. It is our feeling that consumers, especially in local rural areas that these smaller utilities are found in, where consumers are not well educated as to the inner workings of utilities and where they are extremely remote from having any resources on which to rely on for assisting them in their analysis of these small utilities, that the automatic involvement of the Public Utilities Commission is appropriate to defend their interests, to review the activities of those small companies, and that if they feel upon presentation of those utilities that the cost that they rightfully share for maintaining that oversight on their behalf is burdensome, then they can choose to drop out. Given the level of involvement historically of people in utilities, even co-op utilities, in contributing to the decisions of those utilities, we do not feel it reasonable to hope that as many as 25% of any given utility could come together in a concerted fashion to reinstitute PUC oversight. And it is our conclusion, therefore, that the benefit of the regulation should be maintained, and if there is a problem, the utility consumers can opt out. That is the logical way to approach this kind of a need. Excuse me. We do not have any comment with regard to Section 7 of the bill, and Sections 5 and 6 are, by and large, incorporated into the larger issues with which I would like to present our concerns now. The notion that Senate Bill 22 is a backdoor up or down vote on the Bradley Lake question is probably a reality with which we must all deal. However, it is a very unfortunate connotation to put onto this legislation, especially as it applies to Section 3, which I addressed earlier. But also, it is important to realize in the larger context that the energy program for Alaska has been a miserable failure. I was amused as well as depressed to hear Mr. Laresh on behalf of the Power Authority cast aspersions as to the value or effectiveness of the Public Utilities Commission, and I was pleased that Representative Taylor last week pointed out that if there was any agency that should avoid casting stones, it would be the Alaska Power Authority. The performance of the Power Authority under the four dam pool arrangement, the performance of the Power Authority in regards to the analysis of the Susitna project, and now again the performance of the Power Authority as it sought to overstate the positive and diminish the negative with regard to Bradley Lake, is widely recognized throughout the state. It is imperative that they be held in check, and no amount of occasional legislative oversight or limited public interest involvement can adequately address those issues. We have, over the years, I will say we, ACFERG, as well as a number of other organizations who have challenged the wisdom of these large capital projects, have ultimately been borne out. Yet it has only been from very distant and very defensive positions that we have been able to make our case. It's high time that the Power Authority be more effectively control. And if that takes the active involvement of the Public Utilities Commission up front, then that is a very wise choice to make. Excuse me. It is our feeling that the small cost of, as Mr. Laresh suggested, up to $8 to $10 million for what might be the deferral for 1 year of the Bradley Lake project in order to enable at least one time upfront PUC review of these wholesale power contracts is a very small price to pay. In fact, it's our position that even if the decision were made not to build Bradley Lake, and we have concluded that that would be the appropriate decision, even if that decision were made, the $70 million or $80 million in sunk costs and close-down costs would still be a small price to pay for not spending another $175 million or more. It is interesting that $8 to $10 million figure is thrown out, yet there is no acknowledgement at the same time of the sorts of savings that such a delay might in fact bring to us. And I think that this single-sided representation is another reflection of how the power authority is not objectively analyzing the merits of this question. For we feel that there would certainly be significant additional arbitrage earnings that would occur during that year. And given the general trend of the economy, it's quite possible that there would be additional cost savings through even more competitively awarded contracts should the award be withheld for another year. The expressions have been made on the part of various proponents of Senate Bill 22 that having PUC review would be redundant. Nothing could be further from the truth. As a number of speakers have pointed out, the power authority does not analyze the sorts of rate impact and allocation of costs that the Public Utilities Commission would review. The power authority has simply said, well, here's a project. Can we build it? Yes, it's technically possible. Yes, we can find the money to spend on it. And yes, we can find the financing with which to make that money available. They have not made a determination that it is the most cost-effective way to supply power during the time period analyzed. They have simply determined that it is the most effective way to construct a project, and they have used rather disappointing assumptions in the course of reaching that conclusion. It's been satisfying to see that the House Research Agency and the Office of Management and Budget, in making additional analyses of APA's assumptions, have highlighted some of those inappropriate assumptions, yet even those reports have not gone far enough. I know Mr. Cotton, Representative Cotton, has been particularly involved in having the House Research Agency reports analyzed, and we were pleased to see that, at least in one of the more recent ones, I may not be familiar with all of them, the research agency did in fact adjust the very inappropriate assumption that the Power Authority and even the Office of Management and Budget had included as to the amount of gas necessary to generate a given amount of power. These are figures that you'll recall Mr. Johnson from Juneau summarized on Friday, namely that now technologically it is quite feasible under off-the-shelf technology to produce a 1,000 BTUs for, I believe it would be 9 to 10,000 BTUs per kilowatt hour, as opposed to the assumptions of on the order of 13,000 that had been incorporated in the power authority analysis. Further, a very, very, to us, dichotomous absence in the analyses that have been provided so far is that great weight has been given to the amount of arbitrage earnings that can be generated and have been generated to date using the funds appropriated to Bradley Lake. Yet in the comparison, there is absolutely no acknowledgement of the what would amount to equivalent to arbitrage earnings, the opportunity cost, the investment opportunities of all of those millions of dollars were they not expended on Bradley Lake. And I'm sure that if you were to sit down and analyze those, you would find that we can supply through gas technology, and through other demand-side options far more than enough than would be provided by Bradley Lake. We've been very pleased to hear previous speakers highlight the cost per kilowatt hour that the Bradley Lake project will entail relative to other currently employed technologies. I'd also like to address the notion of Representative Cotton's as to the representativeness of utilities and elected entities as being a reflection of the public. Members of the committee, I would recite for you the flagrant failures of utilities throughout the rail belt in recent history as prime examples of how they are in fact not representing their consumers as best they ought. And frankly, we place the responsibility for that squarely on the shoulders of the utility professionals, the management of those utilities. We look at a Homer Electric Association whose concerns have been already thoroughly presented by Nancy Lord, Larry Smith, and are widely known to people familiar with electric issues. We look at the controversy surrounding the Chugach Electric Association, not only in its current management problems, but also with regard to the management audit that it is still subject to, 3 years after its ills became so significant that the Public Utilities Commission required them to do the audit and found dozens of serious failings in the management and operation of that utility. We look at the Fairbanks Municipal Utility System, which is having its serious share of economic problems. And one only need look at how familiar you are able to be as legislators with the intricacies and details of utility operation and management to know that no amount of individual consumer awareness or elected assembly member awareness or board member, volunteer board member interest can possibly overcome the day-to-day, full-time, detailed knowledge and vested interest that these utility professionals have brought to bear on utility questions throughout Alaska. We have followed that path for the last 10 years with regard to hydroelectric projects, with regard to interties, and we consistently see them coming up short. The time has come to recognize that as much as they are co-ops, they are nonetheless creatures of a very small group of individuals who are able to direct them in the ways that their own biases, that their own anachronistic conservatism enables them to direct. And it is time for you as legislators to realize that that's been the direction, to realize that it has failed, and to be sure that we have in place the proper added review of entirely different questions, entirely different matters as represented by the Public Utilities Commission over these basic and extremely costly energy decisions. This is not a piece of legislation which would eliminate redundant review. It is a piece of legislation which would eliminate essential, highly principled, and informed review of different matters which have been biased and ineffectively and incompletely reviewed by the power authority that obviously has a vested interest in building capital projects. Look where most of their budgeted positions are located. And by the utilities who, to answer Representative Cotton's question from last week, why would they possibly want to have something if it wasn't in their own best interest? Well, the answer is they're getting $175 million and the good faith and credit of the state for nothing in order to build projects that they'll be able to play with. And as deleterious as a characterization as that may be, I'm afraid that it's time to realize that that is the circumstances that we find ourselves in. These utilities, as co-op and municipal-owned utilities, are not in the control of their consumers. That, as I said before, look at the voting level. People don't get angry until it comes time for paying their bills, and that doesn't carry through to get them to a board meeting 6 months down the road when it's time to vote on someone, and it doesn't carry through amidst the many other complex issues when it comes to voting for assembly members, and it certainly doesn't get through to board members and assembly members who can only spend part-time on these extremely complex issues in competition with all of the other issues that are a part of their daily private and professional lives. So Senate Bill 22 is, regardless of it being a referendum on Bradley Lake, is an entirely inappropriate piece of legislation. It takes away the kind of reassurance and professional oversight embodied in the Public Utilities Commission that must be maintained in order to rein in the patently irrational direction that energy policy has taken and has followed for the past 10 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Any questions from the committee? Representative Barnes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff, I remember some time ago when we had before us in the legislature the Sitna, the Watonna Dam question. And at that time, I remember ACFERG and the Environmental Coalition were very opposed to the concepts of Watonna and Susitna, and that time encouraged us rather to build Bradley Lake. I'm most curious as to why you have now changed your position.
Through the chair, Representative Barnes, I believe that the context of all representations with regard to Bradley Lake, both by consumer groups and by environmental organizations, was that in Bradley Lake there was an example of a smaller size, less costly, more tailored to potential demand sort of a project that ought to be looked at first, far more so than looking at Bradley Lake. I do not believe that the statements of those organizations was ever a carte blanche endorsement of Bradley Lake any more than they were at the time endorsements of other projects, other supply-side projects that were within the menu of possibilities at the time, such as Chacachamna and others. It was simply a reference to, if we're going to build something, let's be more rational about it. I will also say that the resources of ACCURB are extremely, extremely limited. And to the extent that we can devote those limited resources on issues, when we focus on one, we may not be able to give as much attention to another. And certainly, now that the Susitna question has been laid to rest, it has been possible for us to devote more of those limited resources towards a detailed assessment of Bradley Lake, especially in what we've all come to realize are the much more realistic and much more constrained economic and projected demand circumstances that we find ourselves in. And it is under those circumstances that we come to you with this very clear conclusion that Bradley Lake does not make sense. I don't believe it's in conflict with our representations of the past. It is a more thorough analysis under current circumstances.
Most likely guess that your revenues are diminished since in the past I know you have gotten considerable revenues from the state. But be that as it may, I still believe that I have position papers that was given to committees at the time where ACCURB and the Environmental Coalition did in fact come out and say that environmentally that we should build Bradley Lake and that it was cost effective, et cetera, et cetera, in your opposition to Watana and Susitna Dam. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Bowman? If not, we'll go on. I have one more person. Hold tight for a second here. Committee, we have 5 minutes. I need to move a bill for everybody besides the lead here. On the teleconference, everybody take a 5-minute pause here while we include another piece of committee legislation if we can. Thank you. Hang on, we'll be right back. House Bill 225, Representative Gruenberg.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Most of the people who were here last year will remember that one of the first bills we moved, it was in the House Committee and then here, was the passing a school bus bill. Somebody could get Mark for you here. We've had a problem in getting that enforced. We called it a civil penalty, and the Department of Public Safety can't deal with a civil penalty very well. They're used to dealing with traffic tickets, just mechanically, and same with the municipal prosecutor. As a result, what I'd like to do is to call it an infraction, and I have Romaine Cream here from the Department of Education and my staff, Mark Handley, who've been trying to get the Department of Law and everybody to come up with a system of enforcing this penalty for passing a school bus. The problem is they can't identify the people who are driving these vehicles, so what this allows is a $100 penalty against the owner. It's based on a Minnesota statute. And what we're going to do, if it's agreeable with the committee, is tack an amendment onto this bill that simply allows it to be called an infraction. It's not a criminal offense, as you can see by the second part of the amendment, and it will allow this to be enforced simply by sending them a citation, and it will be no penalty points or anything. It's just a mechanical thing, and I think that, Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, this seems to be, so far, something that is enforceable, if they can deal with that, right?
Right, and talking to the Department of Public Safety, also, this is the way that the other states, Tennessee, Minnesota, have done it through the quasi-criminal infraction type fine system rather than civil penalty.
And for your information, they kept track of the number of violations in 2 months alone in Kenai and Anchorage and I think Matsu at the end of last year, and there were over 200. So it's a really an important thing, and I would like to move the amendment. I think it's within the bill title. If there has to be a technical change or something, we can do it. I'd move the amendment.
Is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, the amendment's adopted. What I would like to do is get this CS drafted up and bring
Thank
it
you.
Back tomorrow, I guess.
Thank you.
Getting late here. I wanted to just go to finance. Can we just move the bill? Does anybody have a problem just moving the bill to finance so they can read it across tomorrow morning?
We used to do that a lot last year.
Okay, there's a motion to move the, what is it now? House Bill 225 as amended by the committee. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bill
Moved. And the committee report so we can get it. Thank you. Crank you out of here. Okay. Brand, you want to sign this?
Sure.
Okay, we're back on the teleconference here. We had a note in, I have a Mr. Kent Wick and Homer, and then we'll come back to Ted Maninsky in Anchorage. Kent, please.
Thank you very much. I would like to testify in Senate Bill 22. I came in a little bit late, so I didn't get a chance to hear what Mr. Larry Smith the other speakers, Nancy, had to speak. But I assure you, Nancy's sitting on my right and Larry's sitting on my left, so anything I have to say here will be closely scrutinized. I would like to, first of all, issue our support for Senate Bill 22. We feel that it is important, and I'm not going to go into specific details because I believe the other proponents of the bill have addressed those. I would like to focus in on what I understand may have been said previously concerning specifically Homer Electric, in that I listened to Mr. Bowman and he indicated that we're in terrible condition. I'd like to bring out some facts. We just had our annual meeting in which over 30% of our membership voted. We vote by mail and then at the meeting. And the two incumbents were running, and then there were 13 other people running. The two incumbents were voted back in. So I would assume that must mean some sort of form of a vote of confidence. Secondly, Homer Electric is not in financial condition or operational, bad financial condition or bad operational condition. Again, some specifics. Homer Electric has the third lowest rate in the state next to Chugach and MLNP. In October, our rates did go up when we put the Soldotna unit online. But then with the new contract we've got with Chugach, whereby we are taking care of our future load growth and taking care of some of our reserves, those rates have been reduced. And right now our consumers are paying virtually the same as what they were a year ago. We are in a very good operational standpoint. We have the Soldotna unit ready for future use. It's one of the finest generating units available. There's been some concern in the past that the unit didn't match up to our expectations, and that's right. We had extremely high expectations of the unit. That's a very fine unit, one of the finest in the state, and it is available for our needs. Basically, Homer Electric is in good shape. Right now, we're reviewing our budget to actually look at further cost-cutting measures, and I think we're one of the few, if not the only utility in the state that is working with our employees to implement a voluntary wage cut. We've got two unions that we're working with, and in spite of that, we're still working towards voluntary wage cuts to try and help keep the rates down. Homer Electric definitely is very, very much interested in seeing Bradley Lake being built and seeing the Intertie being built. We do not feel that it's necessary to have the APUC review the contracts if the Power Authority has reviewed them. Bradley Lake has been studied in great detail, and to my knowledge, all of the alternatives have been studied and restudied, and I doubt that a private corporation could spend as much time studying a project of that magnitude as what the Power Authority has done. So to study it further, to go through further review, is indeed a redundancy. And I guess at that point, I would like to just open it up to any questions that the committee might have. And thank you.
Thank you, Kent. This is John Sund. I assume you're on the AGA board or somewhere involved there. But some of the testimony prior was that the Soldotna unit's about a 40-megawatt unit or something. And you're saying now it's not in use at all right now?
First of all, I'm the manager for Homer Electric, and the unit is fully operational, but because of our contract with Chugach Electric, they, except during the winter months, basically provide all of our needs. So the unit is on standby right now and is not operating, but it definitely is operable, and it was operated a couple of times when Chugach had, or early part of Chugach's strike.
Okay, Kent, Larry Smith had indicated earlier that HEA may be looking to the state for some debt relief, I guess, on Soldotna 1 if and when Bradley is built, because that Bradley will supply the power that Soldotna 1 was built to supply. What's your plan on that?
We have never discussed that. It is no plan. There is no plan whatsoever to obtain relief from the state. That project was financed with REA funding through the Federal Financing Bank at a rate less than 8%. And we have never discussed this with the board, and there's been no management plans to have the state take over the debt on that.
Okay, and on Tesoro and I guess it's Union Chemical Company going off and doing their own cogeneration. What's your knowledge of that happening?
Tesoro advised us towards the end of 1986 that they were looking at providing their own generation, and since that time we've had numerous discussions with them. Their biggest problem right now is that they need additional steam requirements for their processing, and obviously for them that one of the lowest cost ways of doing that would be to tie in some form of generation. We're now talking about their possibility, or they'd like to maybe generate half of their power, because that would produce steam efficiently for them. But we are presently in negotiations with them. They have a contract with us essentially to buy all of their requirements from us until 1991, and they know that if they do go out on their own without working out something with us, that they're going to end up in a court and a lawsuit situation. But the bottom line is, yes, they are looking at generation. Currently, they're talking about half their generating needs, and we're working closely with them to minimize that possibility and yet keep them on as a good customer. I think at this point we're working closely together, but there is always that possibility that they may generate some of their power, but we hope that we can work through that.
Okay, and finally, will Homer Electric sign a take-or-pay contract to buy the power from Bradley Lake?
At the present point, that is our intent. We assume that at least one other major utility will also join in. We can't take all of the power from it. We're looking at somewhere between 12% to 24% of the output. And with that, yes, I believe the board would sign a take-or-pay contract. They did sign the conditional sales agreement, in which basically we would take about 24% of the output.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. We have a couple people left in Anchorage here. Kent, are you there?
This is the moderator in Anchorage. May we take testimony from Marcin Dexter first?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, I'm Marcin Dexter, and I have served 3 years with the Anchorage Consumer Advisory Committee under ACAMP, and an additional 3 years I was on the CEA board. I'm very concerned about a number of things. Number one, the small producers under the PURPA Act. I know the year before I came on the board, I attended meetings almost regularly. And after I came on the board also, this was discussed often behind closed doors. The same thing, the same conclusions were at all times. That we just ignore these people. We do not deal with them. We don't want to bother with them. And I'm very concerned because these small producers could make a big savings in energy. They are in the outside in certain areas. Also, all behind closed doors, there were many discussions on the rail belt dollars. There weren't any real plans as to what would be the best use. What was discussed and what was settled upon was selecting the most likely plan to obtain these funds to get the legislature to go along with giving them to the utilities. One of the things that has come up very recently is superconductivity. For a number of years, I've kept abreast of state-of-the-art and even what will be state-of-the-art in the future. I've subscribed to material which tells me what's going on all over in research and development labs, and this is one of the biggest things in our history to come up, since it is now made feasible. Every nation in this world with the ability to conduct testing and have labs to work with this is doing so, because it will not only affect energy, it will affect communication, it will affect transportation, it will affect medicine, it will affect computers, everything in our lives. And this isn't going to be a long time in coming about now that they have solved the biggest problem of bringing the temperature so that it can be dealt with. In fact, by the time Bradley and some of these other things are constructed by conventional methods, this could be online and they would be obsolete. Such ability makes it possible to use the billions of cubic feet of gas that are stored underground up on the slope. Because with a superconductivity line, there would be no loss in generating power there and sending it down here or all over the state. And that line would probably be less expensive to construct than the dams and conventional power lines. I'm concerned that Eureka has so much input when it is for, by, and of management exclusively. I'm concerned with the incestuous relationships between the utilities, Eureka, APA, Rail Belt Committee, and so forth, because there's very little opinion outside of that circle that is listened to or considered. Lobbying by co-ops is absolutely forbidden by REA, and yet it's being done. And much of it is done under Eureka rather than the co-ops directly, but they're still paying for it. This is not legal. I don't see why the continual erosion of the power of APUC is being undertaken by the legislature. You might as well just get rid of them. There are too many things which they should have input on that have been eliminated now.